Good morning, everyone. My name is Clara, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank my friend Diane for calling me. They called us like a year ago. We run to our calendar, and it was open. And when she said it was going to be in San Jose, I just love it up here. I have a lot of friends up here through the years, and I said yes. So I get often, very often, I get the opportunity to say yes to anything that I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Lori for picking me up at the airport. That's always a wonderful experience. I've never met a stranger, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's something about us. We don't carry big books under our arms as we travel. And I call those the big birds. And we walk into that terminal. And she was very creative. She had a little sign. And I walked right up, and we smiled, and we embraced, and I would like to thank her for taking the time to pick me up. And I'd like to welcome the newcomers. I saw that countdown last night. I'm always awed by that experience. And see that count go from the 50s down to, you know, 2 days. And I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you'll keep coming back with an open mind and join us. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, one of my favorite readings is in the back of the book. It's called A Spiritual Experience. And at the end of that reading, it says, contempt prior to investigation will leave a man in everlasting ignorance. So I welcome you, and I hope you will just keep coming back. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a full-blown winette. And in Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, it lists the insane things that we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing Step 1, 2, and 3. And in that list of insanities, one of them said, we switched to natural wines. Well, man, I had switched to Ripple. And that's not one of your natural wines. Actually, I don't think a single grape was ever near that stuff. I don't know what they did with it, but they probably put some ether in it and maybe a little Kool-Aid to give me some color and some choice. You know, I had the red, the red Ripple or the white Ripple. And by that time, I was in a state of my life after 27 years of daily drinking, which is not to impress you, but Dr. Silkworth in the front of the Big Book and his opinion said it doesn't matter how long you drink, what you drink, or who you drink with. It's how it starts to affect your life. And at the end of that drinking, I was at a state where I was sick of living, but I was scared to die. I'd lost everything that was precious and dear to me. And I was standing in front of the liquor stores at 6 o'clock in the morning by this time, living in the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles, leaning on the door waiting for the man to come. And feeling that feeling it talks about in the book about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, crying silent tears, and wondering how I got from that place to where I was standing. And I'd lost the business, a successful company. You know, my children, I had never been in their lives, and I take full responsibility that I didn't affect their lives physically or verbally, but I emotionally damaged them. And I just was, you know, and I didn't intend to do any of those things. I ended up in that little house in South Central with the drapes drawn, and I know I was doomed to die. I didn't even know I was an alcoholic, but I knew that something was wrong with my life, and I had never had any control over it, as I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know how I'd gotten there. And there I sat, you know, living off food stamps and welfare in an overstuffed chair with, in a terry cloth robe on, you know, sucking off that ripple. And I used to wear this bright red wig that had bangs. And I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, Harlem, and L.A. And looking good was my M.O. in the streets, and I know all about street life. And looking good would almost kill me out there. And I'd come to out of those horrendous blackouts. It talks about the real alcoholic on page 21 in the big book. And I know now I was a real alcoholic because I would sit there, come out of those blackouts by that time, and I could hear that music because, as I said, I came from the jazz world. And there were times of my life I was filled with such fear that I could hear my heart pounding like a drum. And it would pound so rapidly sometimes that I would feel as if my heart was going to explode from the pain. But I knew what I needed to do. The insanity that Dr. Silkworth talks about told me exactly. You heard a lot this weekend about the chattering. And it told me exactly what I needed to do. And I'd have to get out of that chair. You know, I'd look in the mirror and that wig would be on sideways. And I would hurriedly get dressed and I'd go over to the nearest sleazy bar. And I don't know how many of you were bar drinkers. But I'd sit on that end stool and look at that mirror behind the bartender. And listening to that music and listening to the empty laughter. And probably feeling like Eleanor Rigby about the song about, you know, wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. And I would sit there and get into those fantasies. I don't know, you know, there were a lot of other geniuses sitting on those other stools, solving the problems of the world. I don't know about you ladies, but I met a lot of out of work airline pilots. And listening to the stories they used to tell me, one told me he was on vacation. I never could figure that one out. He's in the ghetto on vacation. I met a few neurosurgeons. I shall never forget one. He was sitting on my left. He was very attractive, and he was smiling. And he turned to me, and we were both drinking Ripple. And he turned to me, and he introduced himself. He told me that he was a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. I was really impressed because he looked like he's about 25. He's already retired. He kept nervously looking up and down the bar, and he said to me, actually, he said, you know, I'm a U-2 pilot. Well, at the time, I didn't know what a U-2 pilot was. And he looked up and down a few times more, and he said, you know, I fly secret missions, baby. All over the world. I said, really? He looked at me and he said, yeah, last night I flew over Russia. I took a sip off my wine and looked at him. I said, I know you did, darling, because I was with you. Those were kind of romances I was meeting on those stools. And I don't know what would happen between the legal hour down in L.A. I suppose it's all California. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And by the time that 2 o'clock came, we were all legends in our own heads. And I would go into one of those blackouts. And I'd come to again in front of that little house, little cottage where I lived in that ghetto. At that awful hour of the morning, 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, it always seemed so cold and it always seemed so dark. And it always seemed darkest, you know, right before dawn. And there were those tall palm trees scattered out throughout that neighborhood. And in April, the night birds would come out and they go in around September. And I could hear them squawking back and forth, and I'm in a field position in tall, wet grass. And I'd hear dogs that travel in packs in that area. You know, it's all about survival if you live in the ghetto. And in those days, they had metal trash cans on the sidewalk, and it would take several of those little dogs and all strange breeds, interbreed, and they would, you know, I remember being in there one time in that grass one morning, and this dog came and had a face looking like a German police. I love animals, and he was a German police, and he had a long, skinny body. I don't know who got together with his, you know. But I just, you know, they were real weird looking, and they were looking for food, and it took several of them to push the can into the streets, and I could still hear the zinging noise of the metal lid. It was rolling down the street, and it seemed at that time when it was so quiet. And the face of my beautiful little 8-year-old daughter would come into my consciousness. Those big brown eyes, and she'd say things to me like, "Mom, you always promise me you come into PTA meeting, but you never come because you get drunk." And I cannot tell you how that used to make me feel. She'd say, "All of my friends' parents show up, and you never do." And I could remember saying to her things like, "Well, sweetheart, I understand, but I couldn't say to her, but you don't understand. So when I take a drink, the drink takes me, and then I give it the power, because I can't stop drinking." But instead, I'd pat her on the head, and I said, "Well, next time there's a PTA meeting at the school, you just let me know." And, you know, by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I call all of you my earth angels in this fellowship. I'm 26 years sober, April the 9th. From my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. Because what would happen is Dr. Silkworth says the phenomenon of craving would start. And I just never could get there. But I'd get up off that ground and brush that dew off my shoulders and straighten up that wig and look around and see who's looking. I assure you, nobody in the ghetto cares about how you look, you know, drunk in the front yard. There was a lady that lived across the street. I don't think that woman ever slept. I didn't go down there to become sociably accepted in the community. But I would see her as I peeked out of my curtains, as she would go shopping and do what people do in the neighborhood. But I just swear, it's that obsession we have about that self-centered obsession I always had about myself. I never had much self-worth or self-esteem, but I was all I ever thought about. And I would look across the street and I would see her curtains moving. And I'd pull myself up off the wet, out of that wet grass, stand there in the yard, stagger around for a little while and look over there, and I could see her curtains moving. That's how I knew she was there. Now I have to get my cool look, get her to finger, stumble up the steps, and get through that front door. Lean on that door because I was dying. Physically, emotionally, and I was spiritually dying. Leaning on the door, and I was so sick. And I had wine sores on my body by this time. I had fluid on my joints, and I could hardly walk. My mode of transportation by this time, instead of my white Eldorado I'd had for years, was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. And I'm leaning on the door, and I don't know when I'm going to throw up that blood or that green vial this time, but I charge down the hall. And I get to the dirty bathroom, and I get on my knees and do a few chin-ups on that cold porcelain. You know, it would seem to me there were times when I was going to throw up my very soul. Did you ever come out of a blackout and the room is spinning? And I used to try to focus on something that would stop the spin. And the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. I'd have to struggle up off that floor, and make the run. Break the promise to the kids. My little son was 12 years old at the time, and as I said, my little daughter was about 8. Promise them yesterday, no, Mom's not going down to the liquor store tomorrow morning. See, my life was always about tomorrow. But I couldn't curb the craving and those flashing sickness that would always come in. You know, I'd get like the headache, and instantly I'd start, my body would start shaking. And I'd tip, you know, get dressed, pull on those tight jeans, put on a bad leather jacket, you know, put on some starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders, shove on my shades and those fuzzy house slippers. And it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm tipping off to the liquor store. Get to that front door, open it quietly. Sneak down the steps, feeling like a thief in the night. Cross the street past three houses, get down on Western Avenue. I would see cars in the mornings when it was dark in that time of year. People going off to work to do what they do. You know, members of society and taking care of the people they loved and being responsible. That's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Based on the 12 steps of recovery, and I really think of those steps as being spiritual in principle and honoring the traditions of this program. But I'm leaning on the door dying and waiting for the man to come. Finally, he'd get there, and I'd trail in behind him and stand at the counter. Watch him put the change away, trying to be cute. Well, I want to tell you, I haven't been cute for a very long time by now. And there's something about clerks in the ghetto early in the morning. They can be very cruel. And I was usually the only customer in that area where I lived at that hour of the morning. And this guy, I still always talk about him when I share it. I can still see that he had beautiful teeth, and he would, some mornings, try to play games, and I love to play games, and I always knew how to play the games of life, but I just didn't know how to live it. He'd shove that ripple in the bag, and he'd put elbow on, and he'd stand there, and he'd play with the bag at the top of the bottle, and say silly things to me like, "Honey, who's drinking all this ripple?" And I would look at him, and I was just so angry with him, and I said, "Look, you, I have house guests." He said, "You serve your house guests ripple?" And I would just take it out of his hand and get to it was a little plate glass window, and get past the window and go around the side of that building and lean on the building. And my days for grand drinking was over. I didn't have to worry about Baccarat crystal glasses. I didn't have to worry about bottle openers and proper stirrers and proper napkins. Mood music and the faces of smiling, handsome men. Didn't have to worry about that anymore. Just unscrew the top of that ripple. And you know, Dr. Silkworth said, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Mine was not about effect anymore. It was about staying alive. I was drinking to stay alive. I couldn't die, and I couldn't live, but I was terrified of death, and I thought, you know, if I could just keep drinking, I'll stay alive. I'd take a hit off of that, and it would give me enough, you know, to stand up straight instead of the stoop, and I'd get back to that house, and I'd sit in that chair, and I'd look out that window. When the dawn was really coming up, and probably feeling like the man who said, "I had a dream last night. The life was passing me by, no longer in the dreams of life." Sitting in an old stuffed chair, dying of alcoholism, and I didn't even think I was an alcoholic. We tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, in a very affluent family. I'm the youngest of seven children. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian who was born and raised on a reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina. Migrated to Georgia, married my mom, and had these kids. My father was a very talented man. He was an artist and an entrepreneur, and so we had all those outside things that were supposed to make you fit and be somebody. The greatest dream of my parents was that each one of us would have a good education and all that, but I don't know about me. I'm the youngest, and I think I was born restless, irritable, and discontented. Right out of the chute, man, I could have had a drinky poo, you know, probably in the first grade, because I was restless and irritable and afraid. And I believe that she motivated my life, and I, until this day, I've done many inventories. I sponsor a lot of women. I truly believe in sponsorship. And we every year we do an inventory, and our sober inventories as well as the inventories when we first get here. And I have never found out what the fear was about. It's not important to me today. But I remember that my, I was terribly afraid of my mother. I had a lot of problems with her religious, I interpreted it as a religious fanatic. But for me, I was just afraid of that God she always talked about. And I have nothing against the church today. I studied the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really, went to We Agnostics. And a lot of that has been resolved for me. But when I went to high school, I was a loner. In my senior year at Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta, I won an art scholarship to the finest art school in this country. I won an art scholarship to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And I remember sitting on a segregated train, giving Atlanta the finger, because I had a lot of trouble down there, because I was always in trouble. I can still remember that sad look in my parents' eyes when they used to say, "Clara, why don't you stay out of trouble? Why don't you act like the other children?" Well, what they didn't know, I couldn't stand the other children, so I really was never around them anyway. So they didn't have what I wanted. I just knew it was that restlessness about me that was one, felt some kind of excitement. I don't know if you can relate to that. I was going to go and look for something that was going to make me feel better. And I'd never seen alcohol. Georgia was a dry state when I grew up there, and I didn't know alcohol existed. But I do know now that I had the alcoholic personality, as they call it. Because when I got to Boston, I looked around, and then I didn't really, knew I didn't belong there either. My interpretation of a real freedom lasted about 2 weeks. And I had to go and look on for something else that was going to change it. I'd never been allowed to go to the movies or wear makeup, and I was never allowed to date or any of that thing. And boy, I always wanted to be in the performing arts. And I don't, my mother always said that was the devil's work. So I was never able to take those classes. So I was first time, and I was probably 19 years old, that I ever went to a movie. And I started hanging out in the movies, just skipping school and watching people live on the screen. And I just loved music. And I don't know how I ever got into that fantasy, because I can't sing and I cannot dance. And I don't know how I ever figured that I was going to be successful in that, but it looked good. And I always was interested in things that looked good and outside of myself. And so I started hanging in the movies. And one night I'm walking down the street. And these people walked out of the door, and I could still hear the music playing. And I was with another student, and I said to her, "Why don't we just go in there and see what they're doing?" And we go in this club. It was a jazz club, and it was a wonderful era if you were ever going to start drinking. Bill Wilson, the co-founder of our program, and I believe that this program was divinely inspired. And I believe Bill Wilson, in reading his story, he loved jazz music, and he talked about the clubs in New York City. And when I walked into that club, it was dimly lit, and the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and down at the end of this bar was this rather portly lady, and she was singing this low-down music and the blues, and my heart started pounding with excitement. And I walk up to the bar, and I sat on the stool, and the bartender said, "What are you going to have to drink, my friend?" And she had never had a drink either. And we both looked at each other. But I remembered in the movies they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. And I looked that dude straight now and I said, "We'll have a martini, honey." I said, "And make it dry." I had no idea what a dry martini was. But in the movies, I'll date myself. I mean, Fred Astaire and all of them, used to talk about these martinis and whether they should have an olive in it or not. And I was fascinated by this. And he lifted me and he turned around and he put these two lovely stem glasses up there. He evened it out. It looked like lemonade. Now, I didn't know you sip drinks. Because I grew up in an area of the country where it's hot in the summertime. And we drank a lot of lemonade. So I look at it, it looks like lemonade. I just pick it up, I look up and down, and I dumped it. Man, I was a pig from the gate. But I remember the way it made me feel. Here I am, 19 years old, never had a date, terrified of men. And I dumped it, and it was like the whole world. It was like a magical, you know, feeling. I thought, oh, my God, where's this been, you know? And I walk out on the dance floor, empty glass still in my hand. I shall never forget this. And I'm standing there with, and now I've got a permanent smile, you know, and I'm standing on the dance floor watching these people dance, and, you know, right away I got myself some new friends. I call them colorful. The big book calls them loyal companions. I hooked up immediately with the pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned to walk the walk and talk the talk. I never dreamed that that first drink, you know, 27 years later, was going to have me crawling on my knees like an animal. I met a young man on those bar stools. Came from a similar background in Boston, a wonderful family. And he didn't know anything about drinking. We learned to drink together. We got married. And we learned to do the things in the streets together. We had both come from very sheltered backgrounds, and so we got our experience in that relationship. I stayed married, you know, we did for 24 years, and it was one of the sickest relationships that I think the two human beings could have had. We knew nothing about how to have a relationship, and at the end of that marriage, you know, it was the most destructive. You know, the relationship that two people could have had in that era of our drinking. I can't say he was an alcoholic. I just know that I know only I'm the alcoholic, and I can't say that for anyone else. We had a little son, and by this time we are daily and nightly sitting on the bar stools. He worked for his family. We had a moving business. And he was gone a lot, so I'm sitting on those stools. And it was a wonderful time. Every single night, I was in one of those clubs. Boston, New York, Harlem, back and forth. And what I started to do was, you know, hang out and look around for other people. And then it was important for me to start to visit that little son. They grow up. I can still remember his eyes looking at me when, you know, his grandparents did a wonderful job with him. And it was out of the guilt I would go over occasionally and say hello. And that little boy used to look at me, and he used to say things like, "But Mom, the last time you were here, you promised me you were going to take me to the park." And I'd say, "I know, darling, but next time." So I would try to always buy my way out of situations to ease the guilt. And so I'd send him to a better camp and buy more expensive clothes and more expensive toys, you know, but I didn't have time. There's a paragraph in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that describes the kind of practicing alcoholic I was when it says, "Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles." And it goes on in that paragraph to say we are driven people. We are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I could add it to my list, you know, ad infinitum, all those other fears. And so I'd have to get out of his sight and get back downtown. And by now, I'm hanging out with the greatest names in the jazz world. I'd become very friendly and palled around with the likes of a lot of you are very young, but it was the likes of the legend of the great, late Billie Holiday. So I'm palling around with Billy, and I would sit in those clubs, and it was Louis Armstrong, and it was, you know, a wonderful, beautiful, Lena Horne is still with us, and Dizzy Gillespie, and Sarah Vaughan, on down that line, you know, Duke Ellington, and night after night, I'm drinking with them, and it was wonderful. And, you know, I didn't have any problems with the drinking at that time. It seems it talks about crossing that invisible line. Then one morning I was sitting on the bar stool, and I'm now beginning to look around because I want more. I'm greedy. You know, that husband is not enough. That nice home we had, none of that's enough. So I'm sitting on the stool, and Billie Holiday introduced me. I had named this man in my mind, in my fantasy, Mr. Wonderful. And I'm sitting there with her, and this is, so help me God, she's sitting on my right, and this guy walks up to the bar, and he has, you know, we talk about the insanity of the disease, and I'll describe him. He had on a black hat turned down all the way around. He's got a blue top coat over his shoulders. He's so cool, he can't get his arms through the sleeves, you know. And he's just standing there looking at me, you know. And he closed one eye, and he reached in his pocket, and he pulls out a roll of money. You know, I've learned in the streets later on that a lot of times that roll of money was a lot of ones and one $100 bill on the front. And so I saw all this, you know, he peeled off 10 $100 bills, and he looked at me and he said, "Spend it." Now, I really never believed in God. I really didn't. But I want to tell you something. Those prayers when I was asking for things, you know, had come true. And he turned out to be, you know, I was well into the second step by now. And he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family. And I started to learn what it was like, you know, to ride in his Mercedes limousine with bodyguards, all the hardware on the floor, and the guns and the whole thing. And I'm now painting moles on my face with a cigarette holder, which was wonderful, but I don't smoke. And and I was being picked up by the mob every night that my husband was out of town. And I remember that awful ride. And driving around with all the things that money could buy and dying inside. I was sitting there dying inside over and over and over. You know, I sponsored a young woman named Rita who died of AIDS about, I guess, 6-7 years ago. And when I heard that she lived in Hermosa Beach, and I heard that she was very sick, and at that time they didn't know about the diagnosis of AIDS, but they finally found out that was what her problem was. I remember driving down to Hermosa Beach on a Sunday morning like this, and sitting across from Rita, and I said, "Rita, how do you feel about death?" She looked at me quietly, and she said, "Death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is dying inside while you're still alive." I'd sit back in that limousine, dying, picking the going in the gambling dens and doing all the stuff that they do. And one morning, it was a Sunday morning, and I guess my loving God was trying to get my attention. It was like a voice said to me, you know, as we were being driven home, I looked out the window and I saw little families, you know, going to a church across the street. The driver of that limousine, he's dead now. I read in the paper that he had died. He was one of the big mafiosos at the time. And it was something like a voice said, "Clara, something wrong with your life." I agreed the problem was Boston, of course. If I just get out of Boston, everything else would be all right. They drove me home, and when my husband got there, I said, "We're moving. We're getting out of this town." You know, I don't know if you did insane things, but we went and picked up the kid, and I just locked the house, locked the apartment up, left everything in it, didn't even look back, and got in the car, and we drove out Route 66, right into L.A., because it's going to be different. It never occurred to me once that I took me with me. And when I got there, I was going to be a better parent, and I was going to be a better parent to that little son. I was going to do those things that I saw other ladies do that I wanted to do so bad. I just didn't know how. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, so I crawled upon the nearest stool, that ex-husband and I, and started that insanity all over again. But as we got a little older chronologically, we kind of backed off the club stuff, and we had two other children, and we started to try to do responsible things. But by that time, my alcoholism was in its throes, that I didn't want to do the other things, but we did. We started a little maintenance business. It got successful. My brothers and sisters, who've been very successful in their careers and business and education, moved to California and moved into the Los Angeles area. And they started, you know, all of them lived there. And they started talking about my drinking, and I began to lose it all. Thank you, God. That you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. Came that time in my life when I needed to stop drinking. I needed to find a God of my understanding, and I simply needed to stop dying. And now I'm in violent behavior. I can no longer control the anger. I can no longer control the verbal abuse to people. And now I'm getting beaten up in those clubs. We lost it all. The bank took the house, foreclosed on the house. They took away the equipment, and they took away the trucks and the vans. I was employed a lot of people, and, you know, my life was over. And he left, and I ended up in that ghetto. On the government, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, thousands of dollars, payroll taxes, and thank God for that fourth step and for that eighth and ninth step, because I have a wonderful sponsor that I met at my first meeting, and we worked that all out. Because I was always afraid to go of what they were going to do to me. And I learned by following the rules, the steps, you know, that all of the truth will set you free. And so I was able to get that worked out. So I one morning, I don't know what was different about that morning. Now I'm being beaten up and spent a lot of times in County General Hospital. That's not the best HMO around, you know. And on Saturday nights, being patched up by young interns and being set back out in the street where I don't know how to live. I don't know what happened on April the 9th, 1974. Most of my fair-weather friends, that Bill Wilson talked about his fair-weather friends, mine were all dead of this disease, every single one of them that I drank, and that I wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford. You know, Billie Holiday, I used to sit in the clubs and look in her mouth when she used to say, but when the money is gone and the spending ends, they won't come around no more. And there I am, you know, on that floor, you know, April the 9th, 1974. 3 weeks prior to that, when I ended up on Western Avenue out near the Forum and on Crenshaw, if any of you know anything about L.A., in a hospital, came out of a blackout. Paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life, hey, when you don't want your life saved. There I am on this gurney, strapped down. Equipment, you know, it looked like every part of my body. Police standing at the foot of the bed. And vaguely, I until this day still remember a foot with a cowboy boot on it, because it had a feet on the end of the toe. And I was on the gutter between the curb and the street. And my head was leaning on the curb, and he was kicking me in the head. I know about pain because I could hear him kicking my ribs in. And I can still remember them cracking. I know about pain. I know about physical pain. And I know about emotional pain. And pain has no memory. I am living the life so beautifully described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a jaywalker. Kept doing the same insane things with my same insane friends over and over and over again, and always expected a different result. When I came out of the blackout, two nuns were standing by the bed. A young nun, probably 24 years old, if she was a day. An older nun, probably in her late 60s. She had on horn-rimmed glasses and a black habit. The young nun had on a gray habit, and just this part of her face was showing. And I looked up into her face, and I was bleeding out of both my eyes. She wiped the blood away, and I looked at her, and her eyes were as blue as the heavens. This young nun looked down at me
I called her today my earth angel, because I felt something different that time. The young nun looked at me and tears started to run down her face. The older nun wasn't thrilled with me at all. Because I wouldn't cooperate with the police who was standing at the foot of the bed. And she had her hands inside those sleeves and she was leaning over in my face and she says, "Tell him, tell him." But I didn't know what to tell him because I didn't remember any of it except the foot. But I looked up at her and I was just arrogant and I wasn't going to tell her anything. And I said, "I don't know." And she turned and she walked to the door. She turned around and she looked back at me and shook her head. And when she shook her head so sadly like that, I felt something different. The police left. The young nun stood there and she looked down at me quietly and she said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" I looked up at her and surely not alcohol. That was my friend, my lover, my confidant. You know, I could always depend on that, making me feel better. But I turned away. And 3 days later, she was assigned to dress me, and then I shuffled off to the nearest liquor store. The young nun stood in front of Daniel Freeman Hospital in Englewood, California, with her arms around my shoulder and said to me, "Try not to drink today." And I looked back at her, and they had put 2.5-inch wide adhesive tape. That's how they treated the alcoholics in those days. They put the gauze on and then they rolled the tape around to pull the ribs back in place, and it made you bend over because it was too painful to stand up straight. I thanked her and shoveled off to the nearest liquor store. And then it was three weeks later that I came to that morning. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have always termed this, and I believe for me, it was a divine intervention. A loving God must have kissed me gently and said, "Child, get off the floor. You don't ever have to live like an animal again." And I remember getting off that floor. Thank God there was nobody, the grandparents had taken those two kids by then, and I was really, really, you know, pouring to it, as the book talks about the bitter end. I stood in that room, and there was no other person in that house, thank you, God, because the men in my life by this time had faces and no names. And very often we talk about, you know, the degradation that we are all, you know, alcoholism has no gender. We all suffer the same pain. But the alcoholic woman, I want to tell you, I've been there and I've done that. And I know what kind of pain that brought me in my soul. I stood up and I called my last friend who was not an alcoholic. She's still my friend today. She's a travel agent. She makes all the arrangements for me standing here this morning. And I said, "Rachel, I think I'm going to die." I finally admitted that. "I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking." That moment of clarity we talk about in the book. She said, "There's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous." She said, "We've been praying for you." I remember the eyes of my oldest sister who passed away a few years ago, 3 years ago, and she was 94 years old, and she was a nurse at Cedar Sinai Hospital in Beverly Hills, and I remember going to her and trying to get money from her one more time. And she looked at me with that pain that people who love us look at us with. I don't know if you could feel that pain the way I used to feel it when I'd look into her eyes and she'd say things like, "You know, I'm not giving you any more money." She said, "Not this time." She said, "It pains us to watch you live the way you live, and it's going to pain us even more to watch you die." And she said, "But we'll pray for you." And I've come to believe in the power of prayer. And my friend said the same thing. "We've been praying for you." And she said, "You call them." She said, "I don't know how they stay sober, but I understand they help each other. And they must be in the telephone book, or you ask the operator." So I picked up the phone that morning. I called. I asked the operator, "Was there such a place as Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "Yes, dear, we'll put you right through to them." And a man answered. He said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you?" I said, "Man," in my best street language, "you know, man," I said, "you know, my name is Claire and I can't stop drinking." Truth was finally out. I cannot tell you the relief that I felt at that moment, as sick as I was, that I had finally admitted the truth that I could not stop drinking. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, dear." He said, "Just don't drink today," which, like, to an intellectual like me, seemed impossible. And I, you know, I said, "Well," I just felt that feeling that I just had to believe him. Newcomers, it's called hope. A stranger on another end of the phone that I have never met in 26 years that I know of. Because I, in the meetings, we don't identify ourselves in our anonymity. But a man gave me hope. He told me I didn't have to drink today. And that's what I heard. He didn't say I could drink tomorrow, you know, in the future. He said, "Just don't drink today." And I got dressed that morning for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope I never had that experience again. I didn't know what you guys were about. I got my kids off to school that morning for the first time. I hadn't been in that kitchen for a long time. I was usually sitting in the chair or passed out on the floor or passed out in bed when they were going off to school. And then I went into the closet on what to wear. And when we were doing this conversation, you know, I had told you guys, my story. But I said to him, I said, "Do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" Such an ego. He said, "Yes, we do have meetings in Beverly Hills." He said, "But you're going to the meeting in your neighborhood." Thank you, God. I'm in the closet on what to wear. I got one dress. I got a half an hour trying to make a decision on what to wear. Red velvet dress with wine stains on it. Got out some soap and water, cleaned it up. Got that wig out, you know, and put her on a head form. And you ladies know. And then I cut some better bangs and sprayed her up. She looked great, you know. And I began to shake, and you know, I didn't know about detoxing. I didn't know the language. What I've learned here is the language is indeed the language of the heart. And so I started around 2 o'clock, you know, my body's really pulling like motor, you know. I didn't know, but I was determined not to go to the liquor store. So I went over to Woolworths, just I put on my leather jacket, get over to Woolworths just to browse. And while I'm browsing, I stole some eyelashes so I could look better. Now, these wine sores were like whips all over my face. Now, I take these eyelashes, I shove them under my jacket, you know, and I get back to the house. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. I called my brother, borrowed his car to go to my first meeting. At 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, all dressed except these eyelashes. They come with a little tube of glue, and I'm squeezing the lash. The glue against the lash, and I'm shaking, and I finally grab my elbow, and I wait for an opportune moment. And I slam it in, you know, and one end was up here and one end down there. I'm too tired to start all over. I leaned in the mirror. I said, "You are looking good." And I went on to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember walking in there and sitting down at... I remember walking in there and sitting down in the front row in the end chair, and they started the meeting because Scotty, who's my friend and I spent 38 years, greeted me. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And they had real cups in those days, and I went over to the table to get some coffee, you know, and I was shaking so badly it was going over the sides, and I put it back down, and I sat there, and I'm sitting there on my hands detoxing in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am grateful to God that I detoxed in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with the loving arms of all the old times around and the fellowship who said, you know, "Honey, it's going to be all right. Don't drink today." And I was sitting there shaking, and it was like that feeling of a drowning person. You know, my whole life flashed before me. And what I saw is that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. Had stripped me of all moral values, all family values. And when I grew up in that wonderful home as I know it today, you know, with loving parents who tried to teach me what I got to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn through you and through the practice and the principles in this program and all of my affairs to the best of my ability. I had to learn it. I am grateful that I went through it, what I went through, to be where I am today. I got a senior's moment there. When that meeting started, the lady behind me, and they asked for the newcomer, and I didn't know what a newcomer was. And the lady behind me touched me on my shoulder, and she said, raise your hands, honey, you're a newcomer. And I raised my hand, and at the coffee break, she says, my name is Carol, and I'm going to be your sponsor. And I looked into her eyes, you know, she never said to me, what is your last name? How much money do you have? Where do you live? Where'd you go to school? She said, if you want to stay sober, she said, I want to help you. And here's my number. And you go home and call me. And I did. And we started this incredible journey. And it was 1974. There were 20 other newcomers that we were all together. And out of the 25 died of natural causes, and the other 15 of us are still sober. Not one of us ever went out. And we're of service. Some of you may know Sean A. from Canada. Sean and I got sober together. I have 2 weeks more than he does, and I will never let him forget that. And we started this journey with the steps. We talked right from the beginning about service, about sponsorship. My first job was as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. I had to get a job because of the, I was told that I had to get my ego out of the way and I could forget about all those good things and that good life I led. And I learned a lot about that job because I was able to become humble. And I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous through my sponsor, you know, you cannot be humble until you're grateful first. See, I whined a lot, you know, my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being in meetings. This man came to me one day and said, Clara, he said, you know, at the end of the meeting, we said the amen and after the Lord's Prayer. And he said, Clara, please come down off the cross. He said, honey, we need the wood. You know, stop whining in these meetings and take some action. And that's what this program is about. I made amends to my kids, and I saw my little daughter go off as the first professional black ice skater with Dorothy Hamill's tour. And the grandparents had paid for that expensive training. And that was an honor to see all my AA buddies, you know, sitting in the Los Angeles arena. And I flew to New York and to see that daughter in Madison Square Garden skating with the ice capades. And I got to tell you something. I couldn't get to her PTA meeting. That 12-year-old son who had to go to that ghetto, you know, when I was 7 years sober, he attempted suicide. And he got to Alcoholics Anonymous. He hasn't gone to meetings, but he's back in the meetings. I'll talk about that in but 1 minute. Then that older son that I didn't ever get to know in Boston, that really took to California, didn't know him. You know, he was always like a stranger, and it was always that thing between that son and I, like a love and hate. And when I stood out in front of that house when the marshal was putting the lock on the door, I remember he looked at me and he said, I don't even know who you are. How can you ask me to go to the ghetto and live with you and watch you die? He said, I don't want to know who you are. I want to stand there and you want to talk about silent tears. 18 years old, and telling me, I don't know who you are. You have never, ever been there for us. And I looked at him with all the arrogance that I could muster and said, screw you too. You don't understand. I'm doing the best I can. And those are my alcoholism. Screw you too. He walked out of my life. He walked out of my life and went into theater arts, became an actor, was very attractive in theater, movies, television, very successful.
moved to New York, was working for the ABC television in New York. But we had made our peace. That's what the steps were about. He came home when I was 3 years sober, sat him down in the room. I'd already made amends to the two younger ones. And I said, I really cannot tell you how sorry I am that our lives was the way it was when you were growing up. I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is part of my recovery. I don't ever have to live like that again. And I want you to please forgive me. Because, you know, I always loved you. I just didn't know how to tell you. We got on and we made, and it was a wonderful relationship. And he became really successful. He was ABC television. He was assistant to the news anchors, the 6 o'clock news anchors. And some of the famous names that I want to talk about at the podium. And we had a wonderful relationship. I used to fly to New York and be with him. And then he came back to L.A. and he was part of that group. Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of Studio 54. And he was one of the original members of that, you know, the gold chain and the spoon and cocaine. And he was shooting cocaine and passing the needle. And his life was out there in the fast lane. His was drugs and mine was alcohol. He came back to me when his contract with ABC was over and he got married, had a little son. I have a wonderful little grandson, you know, who lives in Northern California. And the marriage didn't last and he went on off to San Francisco to teach at junior college level theater arts. I had gone back in my business when I was 3 years sober. I have my company today. What I do is I have that same company I had before I drank it away. That's what I went into after, when I was 3 years sober. And I would have a very busy schedule in life, and he'd come back, and we'd spend a lot of time together. And then he called me from San Francisco, you know, and he said, Mom, about 6 years ago, and he said, Mom, he said, I went to the doctor today, and he said, I cannot believe it, he said, but I'm HIV positive. And it was like, you know, like I had been struck by lightning. Put that phone away and I did what you taught me to do. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. He said, but I feel okay. And he said, now I'll stay here and I'll keep working. And when the time comes, he said, he loved San Francisco. And he said, when the time comes, I'll call you. 19 months later, almost to the date, Mom, I'm sick and I can't take care of myself. And I'm coming home to die. And there, you know, here he is, a young, handsome man, with that future we always dream about and those goals we always dream about. And I sponsor a lot of women and I'm into a lot of service. I do a lot of H&I work and I'm on pounds, the jails, hospitals, and you know, I have an active life, not a busy life, an active life. There's a difference in being busy in Alcoholics Anonymous and being active. I have an active life because I love what I do. And he said, I got to come home. And I had a place for him. And he came home, and my sponsees and all, we were around him. And my daughter, and my lovely, wonderful daughter, who is my best friend today. He came home, and it was, you know, that time of that unbelievable surrender that God is in charge. And he got very sick. And I watched a handsome 175-pound young man from intravenous drug using, dying of AIDS, go down to 99 pounds. And I'd sit around that bed for hours and hours. And then one morning he had been very active in writing some lyrics and music for the Grateful Dead. And one of them heard about his situation and wrote him some lyrics. And he wrote us a note because at the end he couldn't talk. They get what they call cotton mouth. And he wrote a note and asked us to sing. My sponsees and my sponsors stood around that bed. You know, you've heard them talk about Alabama, the wonderful Alabama, the great giant, and she was my mentor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just 2 weeks ago, Dr. Paul. And
I mean, it seems like that roll is being called, and I remember that Saturday morning at 9:15, the day after the earthquake. I cannot tell you that kind of pain. And we were standing there, and my daughter and the whole family and my AA family, and I'm holding his hands, and that rasping sound of death. And it was silent, and he was gone. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and those steps. And I'd made that peace, and I'd done that eighth and ninth step with him. I had been a living example, you know, of sobriety with him. And one of the compliments he paid me, you know, a few weeks before when he was still talking, Mommy said, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it gave us the mother we always wanted and the lady we always knew you could be. And I want to tell you something. I picked up a pad off the nightstand because my heart was breaking. And I wrote God a letter, not a note. I said, Dear God, I thank you for using me as a channel to bring your child into this universe. And now you've taken him away. And I hope you forgive me for any pain I caused him in his life. I know he's safe. And that was the end of it. And I prayed that all of them, your loved ones and mine and the divine spirits of all humans that have passed and crossed that bridge, that their wings, they rode the wings of the angels to a better place. No more crying, no more dying, and no more pain. By the grace of God, the loving God, I spend my time, my 11th step, as a constant reminder as I pause during my days, the good days, the bad days. And I give thanks that I am sober through His grace, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the loving fellowship in New Earth Angels. Newcomers, I hope you'll keep coming back. It's the only journey I know because the road sometimes gets narrow, but the vision gets wider as we grow in God's grace. Thank you for having me, and God bless.